The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, I'm Georgine Rice. This week, John Kerry, the former Secretary of State and now U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, is revealed as having disclosed Israeli operations to Iran.
I believe he sold out the Israelis to gain benefit and leverage with Iran.
The nation is making great progress in the distribution of the vaccine. Also gaining traction is the idea of a national vaccine passport.
This is a global effort to literally track and trace and control your movement.
A Christian college takes action in court to protect their ability to operate on Christian conviction.
If you have single-sex housing, dorm rooms, shower rooms, women will be forced to share with men if that's their gender identity.
We'll respond to the news this week of the first, yes, human monkey embryo.
Many of these technologies can lead to unintended consequences that could be catastrophic.
I'm Georgine Rice, your host. It's great to be with you again. It's been a while. I'm coming to you from Portland in my home station of KPDQ. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin with John Kerry, the former Secretary of State and now U.S. Presidential Envoy for Climate. He was found this week to have revealed top secret information about Israel to Iran. Well, the source was an audio recording of Iran's foreign minister, who expressed his astonishment. Americans should be astonished as well. Kevin McCullough turned to retired Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer with the London Center for Policy Research from AM 570 The Mission in New York City.
What happened and what's your take on it?
So, yes, first, always look at an individual's personal history to understand better their current actions. And John Kerry, if you look at who he is, this is within his character. And, he's basically gone against U.S. foreign policy anytime he believed that a political narrative was more important to follow. This goes from his time in Vietnam to the present. So that's just the first thing. Always consider the source. Secondly, because of who he is, I believe he sold out the Israelis to gain what he believed to be benefit and leverage with Iran. Remember, he and President Obama have been completely tied to this joint agreed-upon framework regarding the Iranian nuclear program. So in the interest of trying to essentially now, he's been working to reestablish that legacy, I have no doubt back when he was Secretary of State under President Obama that he would have given up this information for purposes of trying to say, see, aren't we great? We're trying to help you, Iran. You need to join this agreement. It's appeasement. It's another form of appeasement. He had a record of appeasement. And I'm sorry, Kevin, this fits in with every other piece of appeasement we saw during that time when Kerry was pushing this for Obama. So this, to me, indicates that we must insist on an investigation of this because it was clearly something he did to undermine U.S. foreign policy and probably resulted in failures of one of our key allies in their efforts to make sure Iran does not obtain a nuclear weapon.
If we don't address this, we are going to cease to have the confidence of our allies. And when you're talking about the Middle East, we can't depend on an ally more closely than we do with Israel. And in many ways, we've been burdensome to them being able to take care of their own self-reliance. This is going to make them question if they can really fully count on the USA, particularly if a certain party is in power, et cetera, because of the kind of lack of decorum that they feel like they are dealt with. And nobody could blame them for that at the end of the day.
To build on that point, absolutely, Kevin. Look, the Saudis have found that the Israelis are a better, more dependable ally at this point. Now, think about that. Saudi Arabia, an Arab country, which swore at one point to destroy the Israeli state, more in line and dependent on a political and military process as an ally with the Israelis than they are with us. Think about it. I mean, this is unheard of. And yeah. It's because of the very issue with John Kerry and others who have basically said, yeah, we don't care about our alliances. We don't care about commitments. We're after this nuclear deal with Iran, even though it's not going to work. It's all about prestige and virtue signaling at the international level. That's why they're so committed to this. Allies all see it, and it's very dangerous. We need to do something, and, you know, we're going to lose it.
Here at home, the nation seems to be emerging from the worst of the pandemic. The numbers of daily deaths are down. Vaccination numbers are up. Some of the most stifling restrictions are lifting. Well, as the nation emerges and travel resumes, we're also hearing more direct calls for vaccine passports. Matt Staver of the Liberty Council is pushing back. He joined Don Crow, my colleague on WAVA in Washington, D.C.
What can you tell us more about this incredible development? And it seems one of many that's been spawned by COVID-19 on us.
Well, it is an incredible development. And, you know, it actually predates COVID-19. COVID-19 is actually being used as a springboard, an excuse, if you will, to advance this idea that's been in the works for many years before. Bill Gates has talked about it. Many others have talked about it. And this is all part of a global vaccination agenda. And in order to have something like that on such a massive scale, you have to determine who's vaccinated and who's not. Because it's not just a particular vaccine, it's multiple vaccines. Right now we're talking about COVID, but there's lots of different kinds of vaccines that people like Bill Gates want people to be injected with. And it's global, 7 billion plus people on the planet. So the only way to be able to determine whether somebody has that array of vaccinations is through a digital health passport. The most obvious way would be on your smartphone. But in other ways, it could be a chip or some other kind of implant under the skin. Those technologies are in the works. Some of those have been deployed. Even the Pentagon's working on something of this nature to deploy something under your skin that would do your blood testing on a regular basis. So this has been in existence for some time. COVID-19 is now being used to really advance that forward in a rapid progression. So what is a so-called digital health or vaccine passport? It is a code that would be, for example, when we're talking about a smartphone, it's like a QR code. And that, in fact, is what Israel now has. I have a friend who has a QR code on his cell phone, and he uses that to get into different locations, just like you would submit your cell phone if you're going to the gate and you wanted to check into the particular airline and walk onto the airplane. You put out your digital QR code that is your ticket, and they scan it and you walk in. That's exactly what this digital passport does. But it doesn't just limit it to COVID. They're wanting to track people who have COVID vaccines or the COVID injections more accurately. And they can do that, or they want to do that, by these digital passports. In fact, New York is experimenting with the so-called Excelsior version, which already has demonstrated a lot of problems with data and privacy. China has already deployed this some time ago, well before COVID. Now COVID is added to it. China uses this to trace and track. And Israel, like China, now also not only has the QR code on your cell phone, but a tracing and tracking app. The app that's on the phone for people in Israel actually tracks every movement, who you are in contact with. And if somebody is exposed, in this case, to COVID, you'll be alerted to that, and you'll be told to go quarantine. And the quarantine is a little bubble around your home. If you move outside of that, you get a warning to go back into the quarantine. And if you don't, authorities will be called. So that's what's happening all over this country, where there's efforts, even by the Biden administration, to roll out something like this. Now, the press secretary at the end of March said, well, there's no intent to do so yet. On March the 2nd, the Biden administration presented a PowerPoint that we have to multiple federal agencies that this is, in fact, what they want to do, both in the public sector, and they also want to compel and work with private sectors to roll this out. The threat to freedom is exponential. I can't underestimate or underemphasize how serious this is. This will be your passport to leave your home, to work, to shop, to dine, to travel, or even to worship. And that is a serious threat to our freedom.
This is literally the end of human liberty in the West if this plan unfolds as planned. Matt, tell us more about this and especially what the states, some of them at least, are starting to do already.
We began messaging on this, and we've asked the different states to push back because that is our firewall, if you will. And the first state to do so was Florida with Governor Ron DeSantis. He issued a great executive order saying that in Florida, there will be no vaccine passports either by any government agency or entity or by private corporations. And that's very critical because it needs to also ban private corporations. Because what happens if, you know, the airline industry says you got to have this vaccine passport to travel? There's 22 cruise lines right now and 27 airlines that are moving to try to push forward with these so-called vaccine passports for domestic or international travel. The next state was Texas. Governor Greg Abbott issued an executive order almost identical. Now we've had several other states come on with executive orders as well. Montana governor just recently signed a bill into law that says no vaccine passports. So that's now the first state to actually pass that particular law by the legislature, signed by the governor. But there's 23 bills now pending in about 20 or so states to push back on these so-called vaccine passports. They need to prohibit vaccine passports for both the government as well as private industry, because we know, for example, that Walmart is testing, even though it's voluntary, these so-called vaccine passports. Well, you know, testing eventually goes into requirements that you can't enter a Walmart unless you have a vaccine passport. So this is what Naomi is talking about. This is what we've been warning about. If you let this camel's nose in the tent, then we lose our freedom, because it literally, like it does in Israel, and for example, even in Israel right now, if you come to Israel, tourists are going to be able to come in on the 23rd of May, but that is only for people who are vaccinated. If you go to Israel now, you have to wear this tracking bracelet and either go into a government quarantine hotel or go into quarantine in your home. And if you move outside of it, you'll face the consequences of the authorities. So this is a very serious threat to freedom. And once you get a vaccine passport for COVID, under the guise of COVID, then it includes all the other vaccines, the vaccine of the month, whatever pharmaceutical companies or whatever others want to entice you or scare you into taking. COVID's not the first epidemic or pandemic, and it's not going to be the last. And this is a global effort to literally track and trace and control your movement. This is not about controlling the virus. This is not about COVID. It's about data collection and control.
Coming up, a human monkey embryo.
Many of these technologies can lead to unintended consequences that could be catastrophic.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. As we watch the sexual and moral revolution today, it sometimes feels like we're watching a locomotive with a good head of steam, and sitting squarely on the tracks down the line are all of our First Amendment liberties. Included among those rights is whether or not Christian schools and institutions of higher learning will be able to conduct their ministries in alignment with Christian conviction. For example, will a Christian school be able to retain gender-specific dorms? The College of the Ozarks is pushing the issue in court. Julie Blake of Alliance Defending Freedom joined Don Crow to explain.
Talk to us about really what this meant or would mean to this college of, and others like it, if they're forced to go this direction.
Sure. So federal housing law has long prohibited sex discrimination in housing across America, including college housing like student dorms. When President Biden took office, he redefined sex in this law unilaterally to include sexual orientation and gender identity. So under his new directive, in all housing, if you have single-sex housing, dorm rooms, shower rooms, women will be forced to share with men if that's their gender identity.
And, of course, this is not just a singular story standing all by itself. What have you seen in your line of work and all of your colleagues at ADF in this regard across the country? This is not just a happenstance, but this is a whole movement that's going in that direction, is it not?
That's right. We've seen female athletes miss out on competitions, medals, places on sports teams because of men who unfairly have taken spots that should go to girls. We've seen professors punished for refusing to use a student's preferred pronoun, even if the professor wants to be polite and accommodating to the student.
Are there other schools that may be joining or is in this lawsuit, or is this simply one being carried out by the College of the Ozarks?
Well, this is a first-of-our-kind lawsuit. College of the Ozarks is leading on this issue. We encourage everyone in America, though, to stand for freedom, and we at Alliance Defending Freedom are here to help and support other colleges, other churches, ministries, religious schools, other organizations who want to stand up and defend their beliefs about marriage and biological sex as well.
Now, what is the immediate result? In the meantime, does the college have to abide by this new directive, or can they forestall any change of policy until the court acts upon it?
Well, we're trying to have the court rule quickly because at this point, the federal government's already saying that the college has to comply. Now, the college isn't complying. Every day, it's having communications and activities about its existing policies and maintaining the privacy rights of its students. But the federal government is saying that the college has and will continue to do that, that it faces ruinous fines, huge penalties, even criminal penalties potentially, which is why we've gone to court to ask a judge to intervene.
Creation of the first human monkey embryos sparks concern. Well, that was the title of a piece that appeared this week in the Wall Street Journal. And I trust you can understand the concern. Reality today is stranger than fiction. John Hall and Kathy Emmons turn to Fuzz Reyna of Reasons to Believe from Word FM in Pittsburgh.
Before you came on the air, I was saying that, you know, we're so thankful for science in a myriad of ways. But there has to be a moment of conversation when we're talking about the combining of a monkey embryo and a human embryo.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, this raises all kinds of really serious, you know, ethical questions and raises questions about, you know, are there really boundaries that we've now crossed when we've done this type of work?
How far along are these chimeras? Now, right now it's a petri dish, right? So far from true flourishing as a species. I don't even know what you could call it, the chimera. But soon and very soon, this variant will be alive in this world?
Yeah, well, you know, at this point, the technology for developing chimeras is really very much in its primitive state. And so these particular human monkey chimeric embryos survived for about 20 days in the lab before they essentially died. And so people have serious questions if you could actually get these chimeras to live much longer than that, because in a sense you have cells from two very different species, and you know there's difference, genetic differences, there's differences in the process of embryonic development, and so some people are concerned that you're never going to be able to truly overcome those differences, and so this may be where things begin and end, but who knows? I mean, the one thing about biotechnology is never say never, because somebody comes up with an approach and suddenly, you know, a revolution takes place in our capabilities. So who knows where this could lead?
So far as, you know, it's one thing to talk about it from a Western New York ethical, a Western new perspective here in this country. But what about other countries, you know, who tend to be more outlaw-ish, whether it's China or Russia? Their ethical standards are even more extreme than ours.
Yeah, and that's an excellent point. And that's part of the problem with emerging biotechnologies across the board, is that many of these technologies, again, can serve good purposes, but they can also be abused and can lead to unintended consequences that could be catastrophic. And it's one thing for, you know, scientific organizations to publish guidelines, for governments to issue regulations, but those regulations and guidelines are only as good as people's willingness to actually adhere to them. And there's so many ways to navigate around those guidelines.
Yeah.
And then you have countries like China or Russia, for example, that see this as a competitive advantage. They see the ethical deliberations we engage in the West, or at least in the United States, as being a hindrance to science. And so they're going to look for a competitive advantage by, you know, pursuing this work regardless of the ethical questions. And this creates pressure on scientists in the U.S. to try to push hard to revise regulations to give them more freedom. So it's right. It's just not a good cocktail.
No, it's not. I mean, look, no. We're already suffering through what, you know, we're presupposing happened in a lab in China, whether, you know, there's roots to that and truth or not. And, you know, it's a worldwide pandemic. So who knows to say, you know, once like Pandora's box is open, what will come our way in future generations?
And John, you made a good point yesterday when you were talking about Frankenstein, because it's not just about the end of the story about when the monster goes wrong, but it's also about the fact that there was something inside, you know, the scientist, you know, Frankenstein, that made him want to do that.
Dr. Frankenstein. You know what I mean?
And that's the thing that we're still grappling with now. It's a story about human nature, right, Fuzz?
What, pride, ego, money?
It is. You know, as human beings, you know, we're made in God's image. And part of that is that we are creators and we're compelled to create. And we've been granted dominion over the earth. And so we exercise that dominion. But we also, as Christians, recognize that human beings are sinful. And that ability to create, that fact that we've been granted dominion, coupled with our sinful nature and our lack of wisdom sometimes, and our folly, really can produce circumstances that and technologies that really are not good, that can be misused or have unintended consequences.
Coming up, passing on the faith.
Those families where religion is talked about during the week as sort of a normal, everyday part of life, those are the kids that go on to be much more religious.
Stay with us. Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. Having a child and raising a child has never been easy. But as we watch the world around us and we track with the state of the church in our increasingly secular nation, parenthood is all the more daunting. How do parents effectively nurture and cultivate Christ-loving faith in their kids? Christian Smith wrote a recent piece for First Things magazine entitled Keeping the Faith. Sociologist and author, now serving at Notre Dame, joined The Ride Home with John and Kathy.
You talk about the parenting style that, you know, especially in a more modern day and age, a lot of parents just, you know, they're not interested. They just want to sleep in on Sunday mornings. Of course, you know, to the peril of their own child's life. Talk about that, about parenting style and how important that is.
Yeah, there are different ways that parents go about relating to their children. And the first, it has to do with how strict they are with their children, how much they sort of put down policies and enforce them, how much they have expectations and demands of their kids. The second part is how warm emotionally they are with their kids, how connected they are, how much their kids know they love them, how much they will be there unconditionally. And the parents who are most effective at forming their kids the way they are and the way they want them to be are those that have high expectations, high demand, combined with a lot of warmth, a lot of affection, a lot of unconditional love. And the other types, that's what's called authoritative. The other types, if you have parents who are super high demand, super high expectations, but are cold, that's authoritarian. And that's kids with authoritarian parents are going to be less likely than kids with authoritative parents to be shaped by them, to want to follow them, to want to adopt their values. So it's not just how religiously practicing and consistent parents are. It's also the general style that they have toward their children also influences this. And that actually works for non-religious parents. Non-religious parents and atheist parents who are authoritative are also more likely than other non-religious parents to turn out kids that are non-religious. So it's important to not check out from kids and just let them do what they want. And it's also important to remain, you know, close to them, warm, effective ties with them and not just get distanced.
I have two daughters, my husband and I do, and they're both in college. But when they were younger, I'd say all the way up until they were maybe in high school, my husband and I had a lot of tension and difference of opinion in how we should discipline them. And my husband was much more concerned with them having structure. And he was much more authority driven than I was. And I was like the soft one. Oh, you're being too hard on them, honey. How could you do that? You know, they're really trying. Whatever. And his mixture of having authority and being loving at the same time, I think has created our daughters to be the way they are. And me fighting back about that for so many years, I mean, obviously wasn't helping my relationship with him, but it also wasn't helping my kids.
Sometimes, especially in our culture, we think, well, kids are so independent and they have their peers, just let them be what they're going to be. And a lot of parents that I've come across have this impression once their kids turn 12 or 13, their influence on them declines. It's actually not the case. It declines compared to what it was before, but it's still really very powerful on teenagers all the way up into their 20s, what their parents are toward them and what kind of relationships they have. So it really matters, sort of the parental input and sticking with it and continuing to act like parents. But good parents, responsible parents, loving parents, but also parents with expectations and standards and rules. That matters for teenagers. We know that toddlers, you know, sometimes they lose control and all they need is to sort of be sat upon and sort of have some parameters put down and then they settle down. I'm not saying teenagers are toddlers, but there's a similar dynamic. Like teenagers, there's so little structure in some ways in life that for them to know, okay, here's what the expectation is, here are the consequences, it actually helps them.
Okay, so Krista, in your article, I was really happy to read this because, of course, Kath and I make our livings as talk show hosts on a Christian radio station. And at dinner time, we routinely talk about religion in all its various forms.
Oh, yeah.
And so you're saying if you talk routinely about religion, your children are going to pick up on that and will also embed them deeper in their faith life.
Yeah, in our survey, we asked lots and lots of questions about how religion operates in the home. And the one thing, no matter how we analyze it, that came out as the super strong factor was in differences between families is those families where religion is talked about during the week as sort of a normal, everyday part of life, those are the kids that go on to be much more religious. So, which to say that negatively, when religion is something that happens on Sunday morning or Saturday morning or whatever, and then it's sort of it's compartmentalized, disappeared for the rest of the week, the kids learn, well, that's just a little piece of life. It's like the club we belong to, but it's not central. It's not crucial to who we are. And so really parents who talk to their kids, not preaching, but just as a matter of natural conversation, makes a huge difference in outcomes.
Coming up, a window into my own world over the course of these last several months.
My life journey has already been laid out by my father. My days have been numbered. He knows precisely what my future looks like.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment, stay with us.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. I hope you don't mind my repeating myself, but it's really good to be with you again. I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been out, away from the mic and off the air, and it wasn't clear that I would ever be well enough to return. But our good and gracious God is in the business of restoration. So on April 21st, and after several very difficult weeks, I returned to my own daily program. Well, here's a window into my world. I hope it will be an encouragement to trust God even through unexpected and difficult circumstances. Well, it was at February 23rd I had finished recording the program. I had plans for a radiothon the following day. I had plans for that evening and for the weeks to follow. I was going to be hosting a couple of events as MC, one for Paid in Full and another that was coming up during this season. So my plans were laid out. Things were certain about what the future would look like, at least for the next couple of weeks. The next day, I would go into the station and record a radiothon, but it wasn't to be. That night, I was taken unresponsive to neurological ICU by my husband, who wasn't able to wake me as I was stretched out on the couch. But I spent 4 days in neurological ICU, followed by several days in the hospital, completely unaware of the dramatic and life-threatening events that took place in the days preceding and the days that followed. There was a journey that I wasn't certain I was going to survive. Now, I have to tell you, it wasn't frightening to me because my life journey has already been laid out by my Father. My days have been numbered. He knows precisely what my future looks like. My future, he says, is one of hope and a good thing. So I wasn't frightened, but I did begin to talk with Dan Rice once I came out of ICU about the course we were going to take if I didn't survive at all. Well, suffering is a part of the life that we live in a fallen world, and it comes for many reasons, but God allows it for purpose. They're hard questions, but in the midst of all of that, we need to trust God, and that was my challenge. No suffering takes place outside of God's sovereign rule. So my question wasn't, why, Lord? Why is this happening to me? But my response is, Lord, what do you want to teach me? How do you want me to respond? And what is it that you want me to glean from these set of very difficult circumstances? And he manages to somehow orchestrate all things for our good and his glory. And I clung to that even during the most difficult days. Hard times create for us and created for me deeper dependence on and intimacy with God. But that was a choice I had to make. And I'm not suggesting that I am so elevated in my faith that was my first response and it was an easy decision to make. But this is what the Holy Spirit moved me toward during this season. The suffering God allows never diminishes his love for us. And that has been my experience throughout. Now, suffering is never just something to be endured. It's an opportunity to seek God more passionately, to know him more deeply. And faith grows us as we lean into God. We trust him for needed strength when times are hard and sometimes feel impossible. Suffering can increase our spiritual strength when times are hard. It can increase our spiritual sensitivity. It can tenderize our hearts toward him. And it removes the pretense, and this certainly was my experience, that we have things figured out, or that we can control what we cannot. It strips away our dependence on people or things that cannot satisfy our deepest longings, and we press in to God. This was perhaps the most difficult and challenging event of my life, where my health and life were at stake. I have to say that Dan Rice, I have come to love him in a deeper way. He spent every moment that he was allowed in the hospital with me, which meant long days, late nights, just sitting at my bedside, oftentimes with my being completely unaware, and to have that support, to know that he was there praying for me and living out the vows that he made to me nearly 39 years ago was such a blessing. I was sent a card by one of my coworkers that was such an encouragement to me during this time. And it simply said, there are ever-changing circumstances in life. There is a faithful, never-changing God who is always in control, and we can rest in his faithfulness. Every day begins and ends with his purpose. There isn't a detail that escapes his eye, a trial that doesn't touch his heart, or a single experience beyond his compassion. Every moment of our lives is in his care, and he gives overwhelming peace and hope. And that, ladies and gentlemen, has been my experience over the last several weeks. My diagnosis is serious.
but I am expected, according to the doctors who have been treating me, to make a full recovery. And that is what I am asking and praying for. If God chooses otherwise, if he decides that this is the event that ultimately shortens or ends my life from my perspective, I want to be faithful to accomplish everything he intends between now and then. I'm clinging to and asking for full recovery. And as I said, that is expected. But I also trust in God's sovereignty and his goodness. And along with my prayer for healing, I'm also releasing my life and surrendering to him for whatever the future holds. Now, I want you to know I'm planning to be here until I retire some years from now. That's my plan and that's my purpose. I'm so grateful to be right back behind the mic, working with my coworkers and sharing this mic and this experience with you. But before I move on to other more relevant events to most of us, I just wanted to be reminded of some of the things that I know to be true about God that gives me hope, even in times where despair is crying out to be embraced. God is seated on heaven's throne in glory, majesty, and supreme authority. He is in charge. He doesn't make mistakes. He has promised that you and I will be with him. He will be with us even when we walk through the valley of the shadow of death. He uses hard times to get us to look up so that we look up now and we can turn to him always. We thank you, Lord, for your promise that when we come to you through faith in your Son, Jesus Christ, you will hear our prayers because we are your children. We reverence your name, Yahweh, Yeshua, Jesus. He has declared that at the sound of his name, one day every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that he is Lord to the glory of God the Father. He has revealed that his name is far above all rule and authority, power and dominion. Every title that can be given, not only in the present age, but also in the age to come. You have been our help in ages past. You are our hope for years to come. You are our God of the founding fathers. You are the God in whom we as a nation have put our trust. We as individuals can lay our lives. And I am trusting in him for the future. I am grateful and thankful for the progress that's been made with my health that brings me back to these mics. And I expect will give me the opportunity to continue until he calls me home someday in the long distant future. Coming up,
Jesus told them that people would think they were doing God a favor by killing them.
Bob Burney, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Today we're witnessing a rise in hostility toward Christianity and toward those who hold traditional Christian beliefs. But the words of Christ in John 15 tell us, if the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. Perhaps we shouldn't be so surprised. Here's Bob Burney from WRFD, The Word, in Columbus, Ohio.
How can you possibly read the Gospels and be a liberal theologian? It is beyond me. But here is something else that I've really been reminded of in the Gospels and in the New Testament in general. When you read it, not just, you know, one verse here, two verses tomorrow, but when you get serious about reading. And that is this. Jesus warned his followers, you're not going to be liked. You're probably not going to be real popular. If you really, truly determine to follow me, you're going to be hated. You're going to be persecuted. You are going to be out of step, not only with the secular world, the political world, but also the religious world. He constantly told the disciples, the more serious you are about following me, the more weird, bizarre, eccentric you are going to be perceived as by the secular world and even the religious world. The world's not going to like you. In fact, Jesus told them repeatedly they would be hated. Jesus told them that people would think they were doing God a favor by killing them. And then I look at the emphasis in much of evangelicalism today about just being wanting to be liked, accepted. We want everybody in the community just to like us. It's not going to happen. Now, obviously Jesus was not saying that we were to begin fights and battles and that we were to be contentious and unpleasant. No, in fact, Jesus told us we were to be characterized by our love. But if we obey him, we're going to be out of step with the world. And he told his followers, expect it. Do not be surprised by it.
Well, that wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Mike Cook, Alex Perez, and James Blind, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook. But it flew away from her reach, so she ran away in her sleep.